sorry. Mom placed Detective Dixon's coffee cup by his elbow. Be more comfortable talking about what. What is going on? The windows at the Ardmore police station were opaque, inky squares by the time the lawyer arrived, introduced himself as Dan under the sallow hallway lights. Detective Dixon insisted we didn't need a lawyer, and he was so nice Mom almost believed him. But she changed her tune after she called Dad at the office. The lawyer came recommended by Dad's co-worker, whose daughter had been arrested for a DUI over the summer. Neither Mom nor I was impressed. He was a schlubby guy in a suit with pant hems that collected in bunches around his ankles like the bulky neck of a bulldog. Dan? No competent lawyer can be named Dan, Mom hissed. Wanted to hear the entire story from me first before the detectives joined us in the frigid interrogation room. They really do lower the temperature. Try to make you feel as uncomfortable as possible so you would confess sooner. The detective's home in time for dinner. No detail is unimportant. Dan rolled up the sleeves of his dress shirt, a royal blue eyesore that seemed the product of a buy-two-get-one-free sale at Joseph A. Bank. He'd taken off his coat and hung it on the back of the chair, not noticing when the left shoulder slipped, the right shoulder clinging on with all its might. Everything. From the beginning of the school year, every connection you had to everyone involved in this. Everything. Even I couldn't believe how well it had all started out for me. That I was ever sought after by the likes of Dean or Olivia, how badly and how swiftly my good fortune had spoiled. I rushed through the details of the night at Dean's, burning bright as I recounted how I'd come to with Peyton doing, you know, to me. Performing oral sex? Dan asked, and under the unrelenting fluorescent lights I must have looked sunburned. Yes, I mumbled. I went through the list, the way I drifted through the night, coming to at various points, with Peyton first, the others who followed. I told him what happened afterward, the night at Olivia's, the cut on my face that wasn't from her dog. I was wary of involving Mr. Larson in the whole thing, but Dan said no detail was unimportant. Did Mr. Larson... Dan cleared his throat. He looked as embarrassed as I did. That night, in his apartment? I stared at him for a second before I understood what he meant. No, I said. Mr. Larson would never do something like that. I shivered to show my disgust. But Mr. Larson knew about the rapes. He could corroborate this story? That was the first time anyone had ever referred to what happened to me in the plural. The rapes. I didn't know those other things could be considered rape. Yes. Dan made a note in his little notebook. His pen stilled. Now, Arthur. Was he depressed? Was he on drugs? No, I said. I mean, yeah, but just pot. Pot is a drug, Tiffany. Did he ever say anything that, looking back, could have been his way of warning me about what he was planning to do? I mean, I shrugged. I knew he had that gun, the one he had in the cafeteria. Dan didn't blink for so long I almost waved my hand in front of his face and yodeled, "Yoo-hoo," like in the commercials. How do you know that? He showed it to me. In his basement. It was his dad's. Dan still hadn't blinked. It wasn't loaded or anything, I stressed. How do you know? Dan asked. He pointed it at me, as a joke. He pointed it at you? He let me hold it, too, I bit back. He wouldn't be dumb enough to let me hold it and not tell me it was loaded. What if I... I stopped talking because Dan's head dropped to his chest like he had fallen asleep on an airplane. What? Dan's chest muffled his voice. You touched the gun? For like 2 seconds, I said, quickly trying to fix whatever it was I'd broken. Then I gave it back. Dan still didn't look at me. Why? Is that bad? Dan jammed his hands on either side of his nose, supporting the weight of his head. It could be. Why? Because if they find your prints on the gun, it could be very, very bad. The overhead light shuddered and crackled like it had sizzled a bug on a swampy summer night, and I realized what Dan meant. Had Mom known this too? Did Dad? Do they think I'm involved in this? Tiffany, Dan said, his voice high and astonished. What exactly do you think you're doing here? After Dan and I had our powwow, as Detective Dixon put it, like he was my football coach and I was the quarterback with the entire town's expectations on my burly shoulders, I was allowed to use the restroom and see Mom and Dad. They were sitting on a bench outside the interrogation room. Dad had his head in his hands like he couldn't believe this was his life. Like if he could just fall asleep, he might wake up somewhere else. Mom's legs were crossed, her stockinged foot half out of one of her flirty heels. I'd told her not to wear them here, but she'd insisted. She'd tried to make me put makeup on. Maybe a little mascara before we go? I'd turned the lights off in the kitchen and gone and waited in the car, leaving her alone, blinking into the dark. Dad stood to shake Dan's hand as we approached. To Mom, I said, "Do you know they think I had something to do with this?" "Of course they don't think that, Tiffany," she said, her voice shrill and unconvincing. "They're just covering all their bases. Dan says they have my fingerprints on the gun." "Could have, could." Dan's shoulders jumped a little as Mom shrieked, "What?" "Dina," Dad barked, "lower your voice." Mom pointed her finger at Dad, her acrylic nail shaking in rage. "Don't you dare tell me what to do, Bobby." She drew her hand back, making a fist and sinking her teeth into her knuckles. "This is all your fault," she whimpered, squeezing her eyes shut, tears worming paths through the thick layer of foundation on her face. "I told you Tiffany needed those clothes so they wouldn't single her out. And look, that's exactly what they did." "This is my fault because I wouldn't pay for clothes?" Dad's mouth was open, his molars black. Dad hated the dentist. "Please," Dan whispered loudly. "This is not the place to make a scene." "You are unbelievable," Dad muttered. Mom only tossed her stiff, hairsprayed hair back, settling into herself again. "I don't know if they have her prints," Dan said, "but Tiffany shared with me that Arthur showed her one of the guns that we think..." He held up his hands like a cop in traffic telling the southbound lane to stop, "was used in the crime, and that he let her hold it." The way Mom looked at me, sometimes you just have to feel bad for parents. For all the ways they think they know you, the mockery their kids make out of them when they find out otherwise. Before I'd told Dan about that night at Dean's, I asked if he was going to have to share this with my parents. "Not if you don't want me to," Dan said. "This is privileged client information. But Tiffany, the way this thing is going, it will come out. And it's better they hear it from you first." I shook my head. "I can't ever tell them this." Dan said, "I can, if you want me to." Heels clicking against the speckled linoleum floor announced Detective Dixon's arrival, and we all waited for him to speak. "How you folks doing?" He glanced at his wrist, even though he wasn't wearing a watch. "Let's get going on this, huh?" I didn't know what time it was, but when I sat down next to Dan, Detective Dixon in the seat across from us, and Detective Vancino tucked into the corner, my stomach moaned impatiently. The table, smudged like Arthur's glasses always were, was empty, save for a cup of water, mine, and a recording device occupying the center spot. Detective Dixon pressed a button and said, "November 14th, 2001. "It's actually November 15th. Detective Vancino tapped the face of the watch he was wearing. 12:06. Detective Dixon corrected himself and added, "This is Detective Dixon, Detective Vancino, Tiffany Finelli, and her lawyer, Daniel Rosenberg." The discovery of Dan's full name gave me a lot more confidence in him. With the formalities out of the way, I told my story again, every last vulgar detail. It's a certain kind of hell, confessing your most humiliating sexual secrets to a room full of hairy middle-aged men. Unlike Dan, Detective Dixon and Detective Vencino didn't interrupt me with questions, which made me think it might be okay to leave out certain parts. But when I tried, Dan gently prodded me. And it was Mr. Larson you ran into at the Wawa that night, remember? When I finished, Detective Dixon stretched in his chair with a loud yawn. He stayed like that, legs splayed apart, arms behind his head, staring at me for a long while. "So," he said finally, "your story is that Dean, Liam, and Peyton assaulted you that night at Dean's house, and that Dean did again that night at Olivia's house." I looked at Dan, who nodded, before answering him. "Yes," I said. "See, Tiffany, I'm not following." The way he was slumped into the wall, Detective Vencino's chest curled over his little pot belly. There wasn't one part of him that wasn't covered in itchy-looking black hair. "I guess what I'm not understanding is if Dean assaulted you," there was his rude laugh, "why would you even want to save him from Arthur?" "I was trying to save myself." "But Arthur was your friend," Detective Vencino said, condescendingly, as though I'd forgotten. "He wouldn't try to hurt you." "He was my friend." I stared at the table so hard it blurred. "But I was afraid of him. He was mad at me. I'd taken that picture of his dad. I don't think you understand how mad he was about that. I told you, he chased me out of his house."
"Let's back up a second."
Detective Dixon shot Detective Vencino a warning look over his shoulder. "Tell me what you know about Dean and Arthur's relationship." I thought of that yearbook in Arthur's room. Their smiling, earnest faces. Not a clue in the world how it would all turn out. "They were friends in middle school," I said. "Arthur told me that."
"And when did they stop being friends?" Dixon asked.
"Arthur said it was when Dean got popular." I shrugged. "Story old as time."
"Did Arthur ever talk about wanting to hurt Dean?"
"No," I said. "Not really."
Vencino pounced. "What does not really mean, Tiffany?"
"No, okay? He didn't." "Never?" Dixon prodded gently.
"Think back."
"I mean, it was the usual talking shit about him. But no, Arthur never said, 'I'm going to take my dad's gun into the school and shoot Dean in the nuts.'" The word nuts made me giggle. I hiccuped and succumbed to a fit of silent, painful laughter, the kind that spreads like wildfire at a funeral when someone breaks the somber silence with a wet Diet Coke burp.
"My client is exhausted," Dan said. "Maybe you ought to let her go home and get some rest. She's 14, don't forget." "So was Olivia Kaplan," Detective Vencino said.
The sound of Olivia's name straightened me out. I rubbed my arms prickly with goosebumps. "How is Hillary?"
"She's an amputee," Vencino said, "and nothing else."
I took a shaky sip of water. The room had chilled it even colder, and I winced when I swallowed, when the liquid skated by my lungs. "But will she be okay? Will she come back to Bradley?" I looked to Dixon to ask the question that I had been carrying around since I left the hospital. Maybe he actually had an answer. "Will Bradley, I mean, the school won't shut down or anything, will it?"
"Do you want it to?" Vencino replied, behind Dixon.
I didn't know how to make Detective Vencino understand just how much I didn't want that to happen. I couldn't return to my life just a few miles shy of the main line. Those few miles made the difference between Yale and Westchester University, moving to New York when you grew up and breaking ground for your own mini McMansion, hand-stroking your belly, swollen like an overfed tick, as the baby kicked and kicked. I turned my hands up on the table. "I just want everything to go back to normal."
"Ah," Vencino said, holding up his pointer finger like he understood. Well, it can now, can't it? That you're rid of all the people who caused you so much distress? A cyanide smile crawled onto his face, and he gestured at me with a sarcastic flourish. Vanna White presenting the shiny new Toyota Camry only the winner would take home. Take her in, folks, right here in our midst, the luckiest girl alive. Dan glared at Vancino. That's a little out of line, detective. Detective Vancino folded his arms across his chest. Sorry, he spat. I've got bigger fish to fry than worrying about Tiffany Fanelli's feelings. Dan sniffed at him, turning to address Dixon. Do you have everything you need? He patted my back. Because I think it's in my client's best interest to go home and get some rest. Rest. That would never come easy, even when it was supposed to come easy, ever again. Out in the hallway, Dan asked for a moment alone with me. He told me he would be by the house in the morning to have that conversation with my parents that I couldn't be the one to have. The following morning was Friday, and I would have preferred he wait until Monday, so I wouldn't have to spend the whole weekend cooped up with both Mom and Dad, who would no doubt be disgusted by me. But Dan said if we waited until Monday, there was a chance the story could leak, and I wouldn't want my parents to find out from the Philadelphia Inquirer, would I? Let's not delay the inevitable. Dan put his hand on my shoulder, and I stared at the floor, at his shoes made of such bad fake leather they looked rubber. You did good in there, Dan said. Vancino is a bully. He's just trying to get under your skin. But you didn't rise to the occasion. That was good.
But they think I planned this with Arthur or something, I said. How could they think that?
They don't, Dan said. Like your mother said, they're just covering all their bases.
Am I going to have to come back here?
You might. Dan gave me that heartening smile people give you when the truth is something you don't want to hear and you need to be brave. Mom made me take one of those Anita pills to help me sleep. I wanted to save it for later, after Mom and Dad had gone to bed and I could flip through all of the news channels on mute, the captions setting on. But Mom insisted I take it right in front of her, like it was a fucking vitamin instead of a sleeping pill that they later found out is as addictive as heroin. Within 15 minutes, sleep started with those weird dreams that you jump awake from thinking, well, that was strange. I had what looked like a raspberry, a beautiful one, plump and jewel-ripe, growing out of the crown of my head. I kept trying to cover it with my hair, but every time I passed by a mirror, I'd see its large bubble body in profile. Soon, more sprouted. One along my hairline, another by my ear. I'm going to have to get these removed, and it's going to be very painful, I thought. This is the point at which I'd normally leap awake, but that Anita pill blunted the instinct, so I just twitched once, and then deep into the rabbit hole of the bizarre and terrifying I went. I was in a crowd of people. They were my classmates, that much I knew, only I didn't recognize any of them. We were standing at the edge of a dock, and the colors were dull brown and yellow, old-timey, as though from an illustration of New York at the turn of the 20th century. It started as a whisper. Arthur is alive. And grew to an excited hush, making its way over to me. Arthur is alive? I demanded of no one in particular. There was a push in the crowd, all of us on the move, trying to find Arthur. I struggled to elbow my way out, but I was part of a formidable unit. I knew if I could just break free, I'd be able to find him. We weren't going to find him like this. And then I was out, and Arthur was in front of me, laughing. A sweet laugh, like he was watching Friends and something Chandler said had amused him. Chandler had always been his favorite. You're alive? I gasped, and Arthur kept laughing. Hey! I pounded my fists on his chest. You're alive? How come you didn't tell me? I pounded harder, anything to make the delirious laughter stop. This wasn't funny. How could you not tell me?
Don't be mad.
Arthur held my fists still, smiling at me.
I'm here. Don't be mad.
I woke with the bad feeling first. The disorientation followed. I just woke up. How could something bad have already happened? For a split second, giddiness took over, like it does on a Saturday morning when you think you have to get ready for school and then you realize, ah, it's the weekend. Weekends would lose their magic for a while. Everything did. There was the sound of food cracking on the stove, and the time on the TV box read 12:49 p.m. Dan had said he was coming by this morning. Had he? Did he share all the lurid details with Mom and Dad while I writhed and sweat just a few feet away? The blanket had bunched around my torso, leaving my legs and feet exposed. I rolled onto my side, and the warm, starchy stench of an overheated and immobile body rose up in the air. "Mom?" I called out, anxious for her response. It would tell me how angry she was. I heard Mom's bare feet on the kitchen floor, and then nothing as she crossed over into the carpeted living room. "You're up?" She clasped her hands together. "That pill really knocked you out, huh?" There was no way she knew. Did Dan come by? He called, but I told him it would probably be better to come this afternoon, since you were still sleeping. I swallowed, and my tongue stuck to the roof of my mouth for a beat too long. I swallowed again, panicked, trying to get it to unstick. "Where's Dad?" "Oh, honey," Mom said. "He went into the office. Something big is going on. He might even have to work this weekend." "He will?" I'd never known Dad to go into work on the weekends. Not ever. Mom misinterpreted my relief for yearning. "I'm sure he'll be home early." "What time is Dan coming over?" "Soon," Mom said. "Maybe you should shower?" She held her nose and waved her hand back and forth teasingly. "You smell a little ripe." "I could smell like Olivia right now," I almost said. "Rotting. I came this close." I've never been able to take fast showers.
"What are you doing in there?"
Dad would pound on the door and ask on school mornings. I don't know what I do in there. What everyone else does, I guess. It just takes me longer. I'd taken 2 showers since Tuesday, and combined, they were shorter than my usual one. I kept hearing noises, kept pushing the curtain aside, so sure I was going to see Arthur's ghost standing there, a strapping angry puff of air. I turned off the water before I even rinsed off all the foamy suds on my back. "Mom?" I called loudly. Whenever I spooked myself, sometimes the best remedy was just hearing Mom's annoyed cry back. "Don't yell, Tiffany!" I called for Mom again, really bellowed this time. Still nothing. I wrapped myself in a towel and dripped my way across the bathroom floor, pulling the door open and shouting, "Mom! Jesus Christ, I'm on the phone!" Her voice told me everything. I crept into my room, the carpet turning a shade darker with each soggy footstep. I picked up the phone from the receiver and pressed it against my ear. I'd begged for my own phone. When I got it, I'd covered the handle in pink glittery stickers like Rayanne from My So-Called Life. I picked up to Dan in the middle of saying, "Indication she'd been on the outs at school?" "No," Mom sniffed. "She'd had a sleepover at Olivia's recently." "I think that was the night Dean attacked her," Dan said. "She slept at Andrew Larson's house." "Her cross-country coach?" Mom wailed. Dan and I listened to her blow her nose. "I don't even know who this girl is anymore." I gripped the fold of my towel tighter. This girl. How could she do this? Teenagers don't always make the smartest decisions, Dina. Try not to be too hard on her. "Oh, please," Mom snapped. "I was in high school once. You don't have a body like Tiffany's and go to a party with old boys and drink too much and not know exactly what you're doing there." "Tiffany knew better. She knows what this family's values are." "Even so," Dan replied, "kids make mistakes. Tiffany has had to make up for hers in the worst way imaginable." And so, the police know all about this?
Mom was beside herself, no doubt thinking laughably how humiliating this was for a family such as ours with all our values.
Tiffany told them last night.
And so, what do they think? That Tiffany planned this massacre with the other school outcasts to exact her revenge?
Mom released a single, ha, as though this were the most preposterous thing in the world.
I think that is one possibility, Dan said, and I could picture the impact that had on Mom's face.
That Dan didn't find this preposterous at all.
The problem is, they don't have a single piece of evidence to prove that theory.
What about that gun, the one Tiffany touched?
I haven't heard anything about that, Dan said. Let's hope that never comes to fruition.
But what if it does?
Even if it does, it's hardly enough evidence to charge Tiffany with a crime. And if Arthur showed that gun around, it's plausible there would be other kids' fingerprints on it, and I'm sure, with that, a story to corroborate Tiffany's.
Mom exhaled loudly into the phone.
Well, I appreciate your calling me, she said. Hopefully this ridiculous speculation all dies down soon.
I'm sure it will, Dan said. They're just dotting their I's and crossing their T's.
Mom thanked Dan again and said goodbye. I didn't hang up until I was sure I was the last one on the line and the phone made a wet popping noise as I pulled it away from my ear. I wiped it on my towel before placing it back in the receiver with a careful click.
Tiffany!
Mom's voice went ragged as my name wrapped the house in her call. I didn't answer, just let the water droplets gather around me on the carpet in my bedroom. Turquoise colored. Mom had let me pick that. It would get mildewy. She always nagged me about leaving damp towels on the floor. And it would be just one more reason for her to hate me. Mom told me I was not the daughter she raised. I cried, but her mouth never stepped out of its tight line. After that, we settled into a seething silence. There was still no word about when school would resume, and I spent my days on the couch, TV dazed, getting up only to eat or shower or go to the bathroom. Being the recipient of the silent treatment meant there was no one to tell me to turn off the news. 7 days after the shooting, Bradley was no longer the top news story. And when it was mentioned, there weren't any new developments, just tearful interviews with parents and classmates who had been close to the blast in the cafeteria. But not so close that they weren't alive and well for the camera, gesturing wildly with their still intact limbs. Occasionally, a news reporter would mention that police were investigating the possibility of others being involved, but no names or further details were given. So, on Monday afternoon, when Detective Dixon called and told Mom we needed to come back down to the station immediately, and to bring our lawyer, I was angry that Katie Couric hadn't prepared me for the development that was about to come next. Dan met us at the station, wearing his same limp suit. If Mom and I had been on speaking terms, I would have asked her why Dan dressed so poorly when he was a lawyer and probably made a lot of money. My little knowledge about lawyers came from the movie Hook, Robin Williams as the overworked, well-paid attorney who never had time for his children. Dad was still on his way to the station when Dan and I were ushered into the interrogation room by Detective Dixon and Detective Vencino. This time, Vencino was holding a thick file folder and sporting a sly, knowing smile.
"Tiffany," Detective Dixon said as we sat down across from one another.
"How have you been?"
"Fine, I guess."
"Well, that's good to hear," Vencino snipped.
Everyone ignored him.
"We understand you've been under a lot of duress over the last few days," Dixon said. His tone, his body language, his bizarre eyebrows, everything about him amicable.
"And we'd like to give you the opportunity to come forward with any important information that maybe just slipped your mind the last time we spoke." He brought his fingers to his head and demonstrated how this important information could disappear from one's head in a poof of smoke. I looked at Dan, the meanly lit room highlighting how vulnerable we both were. Whatever was in that manila folder matched Vencino's agenda.
Let's not be coy, detectives, Dan said. Tiffany has been honest with you. I'd say you owe her the same courtesy.
I frowned at my lap, frantically searching my mind, unsure if that was the truth.
Dixon stuck out his lower lip and nodded, like this was a possibility, but he had to be convinced first.
Let's let Tiffany answer, he said, and all three of them looked at me expectantly.
I don't know, I said. I did tell you everything I thought was important.
You sure about that?
Vincino asked. He waved the manila envelope at me like I should know what was inside of it.
Yes. Honestly, if I left something out, I didn't mean to leave it out.
Dan gave my hand a reassuring little pat.
Why don't you just tell us what we're doing here?
Vincino brought the file down on the table with a loud thwack.
The force flung the front flap open, and a pile of colored Xeroxes reminded me.
Slowly, with intent, Dixon spread the copies of the Bradley yearbook pages out on the table for Dan and me to see.
Vincino pinned each picture to the table with a yellow, ragged fingernail and read the things Arthur and I had written.
Chop my cock off. Choke me with it. R.I.P. hose.
I wrote that last one.
Mr. Larson had told us to compose a Halloween haiku on an illustration of a grave, beneath the words, R.I.P. Farmer Ted. It had seemed like a kiddie assignment at the time, but it had stuck in my head. Later, I'd jotted it down on Olivia's picture, and Arthur had giggled insidiously when he read it.
"This is your handwriting, is it not?" Dixon asked.
Dan regarded me sharply.
"Don't answer that, Tiffany." "We don't really need her to," Vincino said, and nodded at Dixon.
Another file had materialized in his hands.
Notes. The ones Arthur and I used to pass all the time, even when we weren't in class and could have just said whatever it was we were writing out loud. Some were about nothing. What a lemming Headmaster Ma was, and what a slut Elisa White had become. I'd left my prints in the color of the ink, the same shamrock green as in the pages of the yearbook. My intent, laughable now, to proclaim my allegiance to Bradley. Not that they needed the green to even know it was me. I'd attended a Catholic middle school with nuns who didn't know how to explain the sexual overtones in literature, and so it was eschewed year after year in favor of grammar and cursive classes. My perfect penmanship slanted and rolled across the pages of the yearbook, my DNA in every graceful loop.
Did you see Hillary's hair today?
It's so gross. Take a shower, sweetie pie. Her pussy must smell so rank, if she even has one. There were all these rumors in middle school that she was really a man. A hermaphrodite at the very least. I can't believe Dean banged her.
Dean and Hillary? When? I'm pretty sure she's a virgin.
Oh, come on. Everyone knows about that. Dean will put it anywhere. No offense. He's going to be one of those guys who marries an ex-Miss America but bangs the fat waitresses at TGI Fridays on the side. The world would really be better off without him. Raise your hand and ask to go to the bathroom if you agree.
You are never going to believe what just happened in the bathroom right now.
You better tell me fast. We have 3 minutes until the bell rings.
Paige Patrick was taking a pregnancy test.
And another note, a different day. This one dated at the top, because I started it, and I was taught to put the date in the upper right-hand corner of everything, even a stupid hastily scribbled note. October 29th, 2001. Today, Dean bumped into me in the hallway and called me a wide load. I'm seriously thinking about transferring. I wasn't. I'd just like to say this to get Arthur to remind me of all the reasons why Bradley was superior to Mount St. Teresa's. Which he would. Happily.
Oh, you miss soccer mom training camp? You say this at least once a week. You're not transferring. We both know it. I'll just kill them all for you. How's that sound?
Swell. How are we doing it?
I have my dad's gun.
What happens if you get caught?
I wouldn't get caught. I'm wicked smart.
I didn't know how to make the detectives understand. This was how we spoke to each other.
We were all young and cruel. One time, a freshman JV soccer player choked on an orange slice on the bus ride to an away game, and instead of helping him, or even displaying the least bit of alarm, Dean and Peyton and all the guys laughed at the way the blood rushed to his face and his eyes bugged out of his head. The assistant manager finally realized what was going on and performed the Heimlich maneuver. For weeks afterward, the guys regaled us with this story over and over, the veins in their necks straining with their laughter, while the poor kid who choked on the orange stared at the lunch table trying not to cry. I'm almost positive that when we look in your school notebooks, we will see this is your handwriting and that you use a green pen. Detective Vincino patted his paunch, satisfied like he'd just eaten a great meal. Well, you're going to have to get a warrant to search Tiffany's things to be able to do that. And if you had that, you would have used it by now. Dan leaned back in his chair and smirked at Vincino.
It was just a joke, I said softly.
Tiffany, Dan warned. Really, Detective Dixon said, it's better if we hear it from her, because as we speak, we are getting that warrant.
Dan blinked at me, trying to decide. Finally, he nodded.
Sighed. Tell them.
It was a joke, I said again. I thought he was joking.
And were you? Detective Vincino asked.
Of course I was, I said. I didn't ever think something like this would happen, not in a million years.
I know it's been a few years since I've been in high school, Vincino began to pace. But, little girl, you better believe we never made jokes like that.
Did you two ever discuss this plan verbally? Detective Dixon asked.
No, I said. I mean, I don't think so.
What is this I don't think so? Vincino demanded. Either you did or you didn't.
I just didn't pay attention to it, I said. So, yeah, he could have joked about it, and maybe I did too, but I didn't make, like, a mental note of it or anything, because it wasn't something I took seriously.
But you knew he had one of the guns used in the attack, Dixon said, and I nodded.
How did you know that?
I glanced at Dan, and he gave me the go-ahead. He showed it to me.
Dixon and Vincino looked at each other, so astonished that for a second neither of them appeared angry at me anymore.
When was this?
Dixon asked, and I told him about that afternoon in Arthur's basement. The deer head, the yearbook, the way he'd pointed the gun at me and I'd fallen on my bad wrist.
Detective Vincino shook his head in the corner, shadows darkening his face like a bruise, muttered, little fucking punk.
Did Arthur ever joke, Dixon bunny-eared that word, about hurting anyone else?
No, I thought he wanted to hurt me.
See, Vincino tapped his grimy fingernail against his chin.
That's funny because Dean is saying just the opposite.
I opened my mouth to speak, but Dan jumped in.
What is Dean saying?
That Arthur offered the gun to Tiffany, told her now was the chance to shoot this, and excuse my language, but these are the types of kids we're dealing with here. Cocksuckers, cock off.
Vincino scratched a patch of skin under his eye and grimaced.
He says Tiffany reached for the gun.
I never said I didn't, I exploded. I was going to use it on him, not Dean.
Dan warned, Tiffany, at the same time Dixon slammed his fist down on the table, sending a few copies of the yearbook pages into the air, where they hovered, still as a picture, before slicing back and forth through space. Not even hitting the floor for some time after Dixon shouted,
You're a liar.
His face was heart attack red the way only a natural blonde's can get.
You've been lying to us from the moment we met you.
He had been lying too, fooling me with his friendly mask. By the end of it all, I just assumed no one ever told the truth. And that was when I started lying too.
The news informed me that Liam's funeral was the first, a full 10 days after the fact. A few hours later, an email went out to the Bradley family. That's what they started calling us after this. The Bradley family. And even I, black sheep that I was, received the message. Mom received it too, and she asked me if I needed to go shopping for a black dress.
My laugh was my way of calling her demented. I'm not going to that.
Oh, yes, you are.
Her lips pulled in thin as a slice of grass. I am not going, I repeated, more fiercely this time. I was sitting on the couch, my stockinged feet on the coffee table, hair and lint stuck all over them. It had been 3 days since the interrogation, and I hadn't showered, hadn't put on a bra. This skank stank.
Tiffany, Mom cried.
She took a deep breath and brought her hands to her face. In a reasonable tone, she said, We did not raise you like this. This is the decent thing to do. I am not going to the funeral of the guy who raped me.
Mom gasped. Don't you speak like that.
Like what? I laughed.
He's dead, Tiffany.
He died a horrible death, and while he may have made some mistakes in his life, he was just a child. Mom pinched her nose, sniffed back the snot. He did not deserve that. Her voice went up high and weepy on the last word. You never even met him. I pointed the controller at the TV and turned it off, the grandest statement I could make. I kicked off the throw covering my hairy legs and glared at Mom as I passed her on my way up the stairs, to my bedroom, which I hadn't stepped foot in for the last 2 days.
You are going, or I won't pay for you to go back to Bradley, Mom called behind me.
The morning of Liam's funeral, the phone rang. I snatched it off the hook. Hello?
Tiffany.
My name was spoken with surprise. I twirled my finger in the cord. Mr. Larson?
I've been trying to call, he said hurriedly. How are you? Are you okay?
The line clicked and Mom said, Hello? Mom, I snapped, I've got it. All three of us were silent for a moment.
Who is this? Mom asked.
There was the unmistakable sound of a man clearing his throat.
It's Andrew Larson, Mrs. Finelli.
Tiffany, Mom hissed, hang up the phone.
I hooked my finger in the cord tighter. Why?
I said, hang up the...
It's okay, Mr. Larson said. I was just calling to see if Tiffany was okay. Goodbye, Tiffany.
Mr. Larson,
I shrieked, but it was only Mom there, raging over the dial tone.
I told you to stop calling. She is 14 years old.
I screamed right back. Nothing happened. I told you nothing happened. You know what the sick part is? Even though I was dreading Liam's funeral, even though I was so mad at Mom for making me go, I still wanted to look pretty for it. I spent an hour getting ready. I curled my eyelashes for 40 seconds each so that they stuck straight up in wide-awake surprise. Dad had to work. Sometimes I think he was just sitting in an empty office, scowling at his powered-off computer. So it was just Mom and me, not speaking in her bright cherry BMW with the heat that worked only when her foot pumped the gas pedal so that we shivered in unison every time we stopped in front of a red light. I want you to know, Mom said as she released the brake along with a plume of deliciously warm air, that I don't condone what Liam did.
Of course I don't.
But you have to take responsibility for your part in this too.
Just stop, I pleaded.
I'm just saying, when you drink, you put yourself into situations where I know. We merged onto the highway and the car was silent and warm after that. The church I used to attend at Mount St. Teresa's was beautiful, if you're into that sort of thing. But we weren't going to a church for Liam's memorial service. No funerals, everyone had a memorial service. Liam was a Quaker, and we were going to a meeting house. My confusion was so great it actually dulled my irritation with Mom long enough to muse, I thought Quakers lived in their own communities and didn't believe in, like, modern medicine or whatever. Mom bit into a smile despite everything. That's Amish. The Quaker meeting house was a single-level clapboard home, a faded, somber shade of white behind the oak arms that flapped around it, red and orange leaves clinging to random bark veins. Even though we were 45 minutes early, there was a long line of shiny black sedans waiting in the muddy grass, and Mom was forced to park at the top of the hill. She tried to hold my arm as we climbed down, but I pulled away from her and stormed ahead, the rhythm of her high heels behind me unsteady and satisfying. But as we neared the entrance, I saw the crowd of people, the TV cameras, and my classmates, in groups hugging and comforting each other. It was enough to make me lose my nerve and slow down so that Mom could catch up with me.
"What a scene," Mom breathed.
Faced with the women in chic black pantsuits, gumball-sized pearls around their necks, Mom clasped her large cross pendant self-consciously. The fake diamonds were dull, despite the bold blast of the late morning sun.
"Come on," Mom said, forging ahead.
Her high heels stuck in the grass and she boomeranged backward. A few frosted hairs caught in her pink lip gloss and she spat them away.
"God damn it,"
she muttered, working her shoe out of the mud. As we came up on the edge of the crowd, a few classmates paused, eyes wet and wide on me. A few even stepped away, and what gutted me most was that they didn't do it meanly. They did it nervously. The meeting house wasn't even half full yet. It would be packed to capacity and then some, but for now there was a spectacle to be made outside, in front of the cameras. Mom and I hurried inside and found seats in the back of the meeting house. Right away, Mom hunched over, searching beneath the pew ahead of her for a kneeler. When she didn't find one, she slid forward in her seat, making a swift sign of the cross and pressing her palms together. She squeezed her eyes shut, and her plastic-looking eyelashes crunched on her cheeks. A family of four, the daughter Riley, a junior at Bradley, entered the pew to the left, and I had to nudge Mom to open her eyes. She was blocking their way.
"Oh!"
Mom slid back into the pew, turned her knees to the side to give the family room to make their way in. They sat down, Riley nearest to me, and I nodded solemnly at her. She was a member of school council, always up at the podium at Monday's morning assembly, talking about how much money the car wash raised over the weekend. Her mouth was the largest feature on her face, and when she smiled, her eyes retracted like they were hiding from her lips. Riley nodded back, the corners of her big mouth poking into the sides of her face. In my peripheral vision, I saw her lean toward her father, mumble something in his ear. There was a domino effect, now the father slanting toward the mother, and the mother toward the younger sister, who whined,
"Why?"
The mother whispered something else, a warning, a bribe, however their family operated, and the girl stood, eyes rolling and legs still slightly bent at the knees, and she shuffled out of the pew, her family following. This happened a few more times. Classmates either recognizing the Judas in the back pew and not even bothering to stop, or getting up and moving when they noticed me. The pews were filling in fast, and like in a crowded movie theater, families and cliques of friends were having to split up in order to get a seat. I studied every person who entered, worried it could be Hillary or Dean. I knew they were in the hospital, that they would be for a long time, but still I looked for them.
"I told you we shouldn't have come," I whispered to Mom, triumphant.
She knew nothing. Mom didn't answer, and I looked over at her. Two pink circles had fought their way to the surface of her cheeks. Eventually, some nice old people came by, asked if these seats were saved. "They're all yours," Mom said gallantly, like she'd been holding the spots just for them. Within minutes, attendees were forced to stand around the outside of the meeting house, pressing their ears against air conditioning vents to hear. I can personally attest to the fact that half the students at the funeral had not spoken more than a few words to Liam since he started at Bradley that September. Strange, but I felt a sort of special bond with him. I knew what Liam had done was wrong. I found something like forgiveness for him my freshman year of college, at the sexual assault seminar every incoming student was required to take. After the initial presentation by a local police officer, one girl raised her hand. "So, if you've been drinking, it's rape no matter what?" If that were true, I would have been raped hundreds of times in my life,
replied the pretty senior moderating the talk, so proud of herself when the room tittered. It's only rape if you are too drunk to consent to it.
But what if I say yes, but I'm blacked out? The girl pressed.
The senior looked at the police officer. This was where it always got tricky. A good rule of thumb, the officer said, and we're telling the men this too. You know what a blacked out person looks like. You know when someone's had too much. That should guide your partner more than a yes or no. I silently begged the girl to ask the next question.
But what if he's blacked out too?
It's not easy, the police officer admitted. She gave us all an encouraging smile. Just do your best. Like it was mile time day in gym class or something. I think about that sometimes. Wonder if Liam was so bad. Maybe he just didn't know what he was doing was wrong. There comes a point where you just can't be mad at everyone anymore. I had never been to a Quaker service before, and neither had Mom. So we looked it up on the internet and found out that there is no formal service. Rather, people just stand and speak when they feel compelled to do so. So many people stood to say nice things about Liam, while his parents, his little brother with his same disquietingly blue eyes, clutched each other in the corner. Every now and then, Dr. Ross would start in on a low, slow howl that crescendoed, reaching either wall of the meeting house, exiting through the pipes and vents so that the people outside stepped away, the metal magnifying the sound like a microphone. Long before the Kardashians made it public knowledge on television, I knew what it looked like when someone who had gone overboard with the injectables cried. Turned out, Dr. Ross, the wealthy, highly sought-after plastic surgeon, was no different than the slithery housewives who came to see him, willing to try anything to reverse the damage they'd done when they were trying to pin down a husband in the first place. He could barely contain himself as people stood to say how unique Liam was, how funny and good-looking and bright. Bright. Now there is a word parents always use to describe kids who don't get good grades, either because they don't work for them or because they aren't, in fact, bright. In that moment, I decided, no matter what happened, that I wasn't going to futz around and wait to find out which one I was. I'd put in the work. Anything to get out of here. After the service, we filed out of the meeting house, packs of crying girls three or four deep, the sun winking callously in their blonde hair. The graveyard was directly to the left of the meeting house, and all were invited to the burial after. Since Mom and I had sat so close to the entrance, we were in the inner loop of the circle that formed around Liam's grave. I sensed someone at my shoulder as the rest of the crowd gathered. Then I felt the shark's sticky hand in mine, and I squeezed gratefully. Liam's father was holding a silver vase, which at first I thought was going to be for flowers to mark Liam's place, before I realized Liam was inside the vase. I hadn't been to many funerals in my life, but the few I had attended, everyone had been buried in a casket. 3 weeks ago, Liam was talking about how much he hated onions on his hoagie. I couldn't reconcile how a person could go from complaining about onions to turning in the incinerator, crumbling to ash. I saw Mr. Larson on the other side of the circle. I sneaked a glance at Mom to make sure she wasn't looking and gave him a half wave. He half waved back. There was a blonde woman next to him who had always been faceless and beautiful whenever I remembered her. Now I knew her name. Whitney. When enough black dress shoes covered the soggy grass, Dr. Ross passed the vase to Mrs. Ross. You'd think the wife of a plastic surgeon would look like one, but Mrs. Ross presented typical Mom. A little chubby and all oversized tops to conceal it. What would she have done if she knew the way Liam behaved that night at Dean's? If she knew he'd taken me to Planned Parenthood for the morning after pill. It wasn't impossible to imagine her sighing and saying, "Oh, Liam," just as disappointed in him as Mom is in me. In a clear voice, Mrs. Ross said, "This may be where we mark Liam's time with us, but I don't want you to think this is where you have to come to think about Liam." She held the vase close to her chest. "Think about him always. her mouth puckered. Anywhere. Dr. Ross picked up his arm and smashed Liam's blubbering brother into his chest. Mrs. Ross stepped back, and Dr. Ross wiped one elegant hand down his face and croaked,
"It was an honor to be his father."
He took the vase from his wife, and his face became inhuman again as he sprinkled his oldest son in the grass. Mom didn't give me any shit when I turned the radio to Y100. After all that, she was grateful to have a spunky daughter to annoy her. It took some time to get out of the parking lot. I'd overheard a few kids saying they were going to Manella's for food, and I mourned that, too. That I would never again be part of some rambunctious group taking up two booths. The owners rolling their eyes, but also secretly pleased that theirs was the place high schoolers came to get their grilled cheeses. We finally pulled onto the road. A winding single lane carved into green horse country. The houses more subdued here. We were a little ways from the true heart of the main line, from the sprawling old estates with the maid's Honda Civic parked next to the dashing Audi in the driveway. A gray mist pressed down, blurring the view from the window. Mom said, eyes in the rearview mirror, "That car is driving awfully close." I blinked away the long-distance strain and looked in the side-view mirror. I didn't drive yet, so I didn't really have a concept of what was too close and what was normal. I recognized the car, a black Jeep Cherokee. It belonged to Jamie Sheridan, a soccer player and a friend of Peyton's. "It's a little close," I agreed. Mom bunched up her shoulders defensively. "I'm going the speed limit." I pressed my cheek against the cool glass and looked beyond the side-view mirror again. "He's just trying to drive fast to impress his friends." "Moron," Mom muttered. "After everything that's happened, the last thing the school needs is a car full of more dead teenagers." Mom kept on going the speed limit, her eyes slicing sideways every few seconds. "Tiffany, they're seriously too close." She checked one more time. "Do you know them? Can you signal to them or something?" "Mom, I'm not signaling to them." I pressed myself closer to the door. "God, this is very dangerous." Mom's knuckles were white on the wheel. "I'd pull over, but I'm afraid to slow down in case they..." "Oh!" Both Mom and I lurched forward as the lip of Jamie's vehicle bumped us from behind. The wheel spun frantically under Mom's hands, and it steered us right into the gummy, pockmarked field. By the time Mom stilled the wheel and slammed on the brakes, we were 30 or so feet off the road, our tires dunked halfway in the muck. "Goddamn assholes!" Mom gasped. She brought a trembling hand to her chest before turning to look at me. "Are you okay?" Before I could tell her, no, I wasn't okay, Mom smacked the center console with an open hand. "Assholes." There was talk that I should consider other options for high school. But the idea of starting over somewhere new, of having to find my ranking in a new pecking order, all of it made me want to lie down and take a long nap. Maligned as I was at Bradley, I found comfort in knowing where I stood. That I could just go to class and eat lunch with the shark and go home to study, focus on chiseling my tunnel out of there. At one point, Mom mentioned homeschooling, but she quickly retracted the offer because she said she was at the point in her life where her body was changing. "Mom," I'd groaned. And for some reason, I had the ability to press her buttons in a way nobody else could. "Feelings mutual," I almost told her, but decided against it, on account of the button pushing and all. The school balked when Mom told them I was coming back.
"I'm surprised," Headmaster Ma said, "that Tiffany would even want to come back. I'm not sure it's the right decision for her."
He paused.
"I'm not sure it's the right decision for us."
There wasn't enough evidence to charge me with any crime, but that didn't stop the court of public opinion from trying me. There were the notes and the yearbook ramblings, my prints that turned up on the gun along with the killers. Anita, who I'd trusted, had determined that I showed little emotion for my dead classmates, and that I seemed excited to return to school now that my problem peers had been extinguished. The most damning claim came from Dean, who insisted Arthur handed me the gun and told me to kill